Good, he said. I know Surly well. The foreman led the way to Surly's house, about 100 yards off to the right. Almost all the workmen on the pier had left their jobs to come see the three strangers who had appeared at the dock. Now they lined the route, looking curiously at the foreman and his three companions. Anderson knocked at the manager's door, and after a moment, Surly himself opened it. He was in his shirt sleeves, and he still sported his big handlebar moustache. When he saw the three men, he stepped back, and a look of disbelief came over his face. For a long moment, he stood shocked and silent before he spoke. "Who the hell are you?" he said at last. The man in the center stepped forward. "My name is Shackleton," he replied in a quiet voice. Again, there was silence. Some said that Surly turned away and wept. Epilogue. The crossing of South Georgia has been accomplished only by one other party. That was almost 40 years later in 1955 by a British survey team under the able leadership of Duncan Cass. That party was made up of expert climbers and was well equipped with everything needed for the journey. Even so, they found it treacherous going. Writing from the scene in October 1955, Cass explained that to make the crossing, two routes were available, the high road and the low road. "In distance," Cass wrote, "they are nowhere more than 10 miles apart. In difficulty, they are hardly comparable. We today are travelling easily and unhurriedly. We are fit men with our sledges and tents and ample food and time. We break new ground, but with the leisure and opportunity to probe ahead. We pick and choose our hazards, accepting only the calculated risk. No lives depend upon our success, except our own. We take the high road. They, Shackleton, Worsley and Crean, took the low road. I do not know how they did it. Except they had to. Three men of the heroic age of Antarctic exploration, with 50 feet of rope between them, and a carpenter's adze. Every comfort the whaling station could provide was placed at the disposal of Shackleton, Worsley and Crean. They first enjoyed the glorious luxury of a long bath, followed by a shave. Then new clothes were given them from the station's storehouse. That night, after a hearty dinner, Worsley went on board the whale catcher Samson for the trip around South Georgia to Peggotty Camp, where McNeish, McCarthy and Vincent were waiting. The Samson arrived the following morning at King Harkin Bay. Very little is known about the meeting, except that the three castaways at first failed to recognize Worsley because his appearance was so drastically altered now that he was shaved and had on fresh clothes. McNeish, McCarthy and Vincent were taken on board the whale catcher, and the Caird too was loaded. The Samson arrived back at Stromness the following day, May the 22nd. Shackleton, meanwhile, had arranged for the use of a large wooden whaler, the Southern Sky, in which to return to Elephant Island for the relief of the party there. That evening, a sort of crude reception was held in what Worsley described as a large room full of captains and mates and sailors, and hazy with tobacco smoke. Four white-haired veteran Norwegian skippers came forward. Their spokesman, speaking in Norse, with Surly translating, said that they had sailed the Antarctic seas for 40 years, and that they wanted to shake the hands of the men who could bring an open 22-foot boat from Elephant Island through the Drake Passage to South Georgia. Then every man in that room stood up, and the four old skippers took Shackleton and Worsley and Crean by the hand and congratulated them on what they had done. Many of the whalemen were bearded and dressed in heavy sweaters and sea boots. There was no formality, no speeches. They had no medals or decorations to bestow, only their heartfelt admiration for an accomplishment which perhaps only they would ever fully appreciate. And their sincerity lent to the scene a simple but profoundly moving solemnity. Of the honours that followed, and there were many, possibly none ever exceeded that night of May the 22nd, 1916, when, in a dingy warehouse shack on South Georgia, with the smell of rotting whale carcasses in the air, the whaler men of the Southern Ocean stepped forward, one by one, and silently shook hands with Shackleton, Worsley, and Crean. The following morning, less than 72 hours after arriving at Stromness from across the mountains, Shackleton and his two companions set out for Elephant Island. It was the beginning of a maddeningly frustrating series of rescue attempts, lasting more than 3 months, during which the pack ice surrounding Elephant Island seemed resolutely determined that no rescue ship would get through to relieve the castaways. The Southern Sky encountered ice only 3 days out from South Georgia, and less than a week later she was forced to return to port. Within 10 days, however, Shackleton had obtained from the Uruguayan government the loan of a small survey vessel, the Instituto de Pesca, No. 1, for a second attempt to rescue his men. She limped home 6 days later, severely damaged by the ice through which Shackleton had tried to push her. A third attempt was made in a bulky wooden schooner, the Emma, which Shackleton chartered. She was at sea for nearly 3 weeks, during which it was a struggle merely to keep her afloat, much less to effect a rescue. The Emma never approached Elephant Island closer than 100 miles. It was now August the 3rd, nearly 3.5 months since the Caird had sailed for South Georgia. Throughout each failure of the subsequent rescue attempts, Shackleton's anxiety had risen to the extent that Worsley said he had never seen him so on edge. He had constantly appealed to the government back in England to send a proper ice vessel to get through the pack. Now word came that the Discovery, which had originally carried Scott to the Antarctic in 1901, was finally on her way from England. But it would take weeks for her to arrive, and Shackleton was in no mood to sit idly by and wait. Instead, he appealed to the Chilean government for the use of an ancient seagoing tug, the Yilcho. He promised not to take her into any ice, for she was steel-hulled, and her ability to weather the sea, much less any pack, was doubtful. The request was granted, and the Yilcho sailed on August the 25th. This time, the fates were willing. 5 days later, on August the 30th, Worsley logged, 5:25 a.m. Full speed, 11:10 a.m. Base of land, faintly visible. Threading our way between lumps, ice, reefs and grounded bergs. 1:10 p.m. Sight the camp to southwest. For the 22 castaways on Elephant Island, August the 30th began like almost any other day. At sunrise, the weather was clear and cold, giving promise of a fine day. But before long, heavy clouds rolled in, and the scene once more became, as Audley's recorded, the prevailing gloom to which we are now so inured. As always, almost everyone tramped individually to the top of the lookout bluff to satisfy himself once more that there was no ship to be seen. By now, they did so more out of habit than of hope. It was simply a ritual to which they had become accustomed, and they climbed the bluff without anticipation and returned to the hut without disappointment. It had been 4 months and 6 days since the Caird had left, and there was not a man among them who still believed seriously that she had survived the journey to South Georgia. It was now only a matter of time until a party was sent in the Wills on the perilous journey to Deception Island. After breakfast, all hands got busy digging snow from around the hut. But later in the morning, the tide was low, and they decided to postpone their digging in order to gather limpets, a small crustacean, which had been found in some numbers in the water off the spit. Wally Howe was acting as cook, and he was preparing a lunch of boiled seal's backbone, a dish of which everyone had become extremely fond. The hoosh was ready about 12:45, and they all gathered in the hut, except Marston, who had gone to the lookout bluff to make some thumbnail sketches. A few minutes later, they heard his footsteps running along the path, but nobody paid much attention. He was simply late for lunch. Then he put his head inside and spoke to Wilde in a tone so breathless that some of the men thought he sounded casual.
"Hadn't we better send up some smoke signals?"
he asked. For a moment there was silence, and then as one man they grasped what Marston was saying. Before there was time for a reply, Audley's recorded, there was a rush of members tumbling over one another, all mixed up with mugs of seal hoosh, making a simultaneous dive for the door hole, which was immediately torn to shreds, so that those members who could not pass through it on account of the crush made their exits through the wall, or what remained of it. Some put their boots on, others didn't bother. James put his on the wrong feet. Sure enough, there was a small ship, only about a mile offshore. Macklin dashed to the lookout bluff, tearing off his Burberry jacket as he ran. There he tied it onto the halyard of the oar that served as their flagpole, but he was only able to hoist it part of the way up before the halyard jammed. Shackleton saw the signal at half-staff, and his heart sank, he later said, because he took it to be a sign that some of the party had been lost. Hurley gathered up all the sennagrass he could find, then poured over it some blubber oil and 2 gallons of paraffin they still had. He had a hard time lighting it, and when it finally ignited, almost with an explosion, it produced more flame than smoke. But no matter. The ship was headed toward the spit. Wilde, meanwhile, had gone to the water's edge and was signalling from there the best place to send in a boat. And Howe had broken open a tin of precious biscuits and was offering them around. Few men, however, stopped to have one. Even so rare a treat held little appeal in the excitement of the moment. Macklin returned to the hut and lifted Blackborough to his shoulders, then carried him to a position on the rocks near Wilde, where he might better see the thrilling sight. The ship approached to within several hundred yards, then stopped. The men ashore could see a boat being lowered. 4 men got into it, followed by the sturdy, square-set figure they knew so well. Shackleton. A spontaneous cheer went up. In fact, the excitement ashore was so intense that many men actually were giggling. Within a few minutes, the boat was near enough for Shackleton to be heard.
"Are you all right?" he shouted.
"All well," they replied.
Wilde guided the boat to a safe place among the rocks, but because of the ice around the spit, it was impossible to make a landing, so the boat was held a few feet off. Wilde urged Shackleton to come ashore, if only briefly, to see how they had fixed the hut in which they had waited 4 long months. But Shackleton, though he was smiling and obviously relieved, was still quite noticeably anxious and wanted only to be away. He declined Wilde's offer and urged the men to get on board as quickly as possible. Certainly no great urging was needed, and one at a time they jumped from the rocks into the boat, leaving behind them, without a second thought, dozens of personal little items which only an hour before had been considered almost indispensable. One load was rowed out to the Yelcho, and then a second. Throughout it all, Worsley had watched anxiously from the bridge of the ship. Finally, he logged, 2:10, all well, at last, 2:15, full speed ahead. Macklin wrote, "I stayed on deck to watch Elephant Island recede in the distance. I could still see my Burberry jacket flapping in the breeze on the hillside. No doubt it will flap there, to the wonderment of gulls and penguins, till one of our familiar gales blows it all to ribbons."
This concludes the reading of Endurance, Shackleton's Incredible Voyage, by Alfred Lansing. Copyright 1959 by Alfred Lansing. This book was read by Simon Preble. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Curtis Brown Limited, and was produced in 2007 by Blackstone Audio Incorporated, which holds the copyright.